Welcome to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. Military veterans lead three lives. Their time before they go into the military experience is probably the same as most of us. Their time in the military, experiences that are 99.5% different than the rest of the civilian world. And their time after the military, a point where their unique military experiences and the experiences the rest of us have begin to merge once again. Like the majority of persons in the civilian world, most military veterans move on to a traditional job in the civilian sector, 9-to-5, steady paycheck. Some explore a route less traveled. They venture into entrepreneurial waters or take up a career so disparate from their military service that one is compelled to ask why. On American Warrior Radio, we like to feature these veteran entrepreneurs, and today we have a doozy, ladies and gentlemen, and adding icing to the cake, he is a master storyteller, and as you know, we're all about the power of storytelling here at American Warrior Radio. Given the subject matter of today's show, I've invited our occasional guest host, John Essinger, to join me as my co-pilot today. John, welcome back.
Thank you, sir. I'm just happy to be here.
All right. Well, let's get right into it. Our guest today is a Vietnam veteran who has appeared in over 50 films, 100 television shows, and 50 stage plays. He's also an accomplished writer and established himself as an expert in one particular genre, the American West. His first book, Tombstone, The Guns and Gear, has been lauded by Flaterman's Guide to Antique Weapons as one of the 100 books every collector should have on their shelf. His book, The Fringe of Hollywood, The Art of Making a Western, is widely recognized in the film industry as the guidebook to producing a historically accurate Western on time and under budget. He's a technical consultant and makes regular appearances on both the History Channel and the Discovery Channel, and he writes poetry. Welcome to American Warrior Radio, Peter Sciarrico.
Well, thank you. I don't have to say anything now. You said it all. It's we're done. Okay.
Not bad for a beginner. John is from a wide spot in the road called Texahoma.
Yeah, up in the Oklahoma Panhandle. It's called No Man's Land, and there's a reason for that.
Oh, well, yeah. Okay. So that's why I brought him in. You're a cowboy expert from New Jersey?
Ride a horse the way I ride, shoot a gun the way I shoot. Yeah, New Jersey. Yeah.
How on earth did a young man from New Jersey become a Western expert?
All right, I'm an old guy. So I grew up in the 50s as a little kid watching all the Western movies. So,
okay.
Whether it was Roy Rogers or Gene Autry, Hopalong Cassidy, The Lone Ranger, which I still watch all the time. And I grew up with that. And what they interested me in most was their horsemanship. And the horse is the animal of New Jersey.
I did not know that.
I did not know that either until I started using horses. When I was a little kid at 10 years old, I used to walk 2 miles to a park to a place where they rented horses out. And I would have to shovel up all the horses, and the guy would let me, okay, now we'll put you on a horse, Pete. So I would ride and have fun. And I always loved the West. Then after that, again, high school, it was all baseball and football and sports. And then afterwards, I didn't know what I wanted to do in life. I had no idea at all. And let's have a story. All right. When I was 15 years old, my older brother was 20, and he and my father literally had a fist fight because he wanted to get married. And that's, you know, they were arguing about it and fighting about it and everything else. And I watched this, I witnessed it, and somewhere along the line I said, I'm never going to ask my father for anything because I'm not going to upset him. And after high school, I wanted to play baseball. I got hurt, my baseball career was over, and I said, okay, I'm not going to ask my father to send me to college to do something that I didn't know what to do. So I joined the Air Force.
Now, we're talking about, this is right before or right in the middle of Vietnam, right?
So you volunteered. I graduated in 64.
Okay.
The Gulf of Tonkin happened just prior to that. And I remember telling my friend, I said, hey, we're at war. Now, all of my uncles, a lot of my relatives, I had relatives that served in World War I. I had relatives, all my uncles served in World War II or Korea. And I said, it's part of my duty. It's part of what I have to do. And that's why I joined. And the rest was history. Now, I was studying electronics. And that's what I wanted to go into. And I figured maybe that could lead into my life.
Mm-hmm.
So they made me an instrument repairman. And After tech school, I went down to Charleston Air Force Base, 444th Fighter Interceptor Squadron. And I had a sergeant, Sergeant Elwin R. Giles, who is probably my biggest inspiration in life. He had positive thinking little sayings on the bulletin board every day when we went in. And one time, I couldn't remove a gyro from a plane, from an F-101. 214L is the panel I had to lift off, and I couldn't get it out. And the next day, he reamed me good. And he said, listen, anything one man can make, another man can fix.
Hmm.
And that it got me going. And I'm not a one-thing-doing guy. I like to do 10 things. So I played on the squadron baseball team. I attended Florida State University at night, which had an extension course at Charleston, and I worked all day in the shop. And then I said, well, they put me on night shift. And that was even better because now I had the day free where I got a part-time job or a full-time job. Actually, I worked 40 hours a week for a whole dollar an hour. So I could save enough money to buy a car because I didn't want to ask – again, I didn't ask anybody for anything. And I was doing all of that and studying for my five level and studied and studied and studied, and I didn't know. And there was another fellow who had time and grade. He was in the service like 3 weeks longer than I was, and so he always got me on that. But we finally took the test at the same time, and he barely passed. And then Sergeant Giles called me into his office by his desk, and I thought, oh, my God, I flunked the test. I'm going to stay at three level. And he congratulated me after giving me a hard time, and he said that I just scored the highest score ever recorded in the Air Force. It was almost a perfect score. So, and I was shocked.
So now you knew not only volunteered to join the Air Force, you weren't drafted, but then you also volunteered to go out to Vietnam.
I volunteered after they gave me another stripe when all that happened, and then they sent me up to Dow Air Force Base in Maine, 75th Fighter Interceptor Squadron. So I went from South Carolina, where I was going to the beach, to 25 below in Maine. And the tech sergeant who was in charge of the shop was shipped out, and they put me in charge of the shop. Now, mm-hmm. I was there. The inspector general came in and inspected the whole squadron, and, of course, my shop got the highest grade. Luckily, because I'm like Oscar Madison. I'm technically a sloppy guy. But the sergeant before me was perfect. And everything, and it just was a week after I took over. So they thought I was like the hero. Sure.
It's like the presidency. You can,
it was like, oh, this is great. And so I was there as the shop chief. And again, I had guys working under me that had been in the service 2 or 3 months longer than me. And they were all upset with me. And because of the cold, and I was going to the University of Maine, and I was taking night classes, and then I said, you know what, Vietnam is going on, I want to go. So I put a volunteer statement in, which was a long process, because I volunteered, and then they said I had to go and get a physical. And I hurt my knee, I had ruined my knee playing football in high school. So I went down, I went into the doctor, and he said, what's the matter? I said, well, I got a bad knee. So for 15, 20 minutes, I'm on a table, and he's pulling on my knee, and he's doing all sorts of things to me, and I'm laughing about it because I said, what are you doing? After 15, 20 minutes, I said, well, what's the matter? He said, you got a bad knee. I said, I told you that when I walked in here.
Thanks, Doc. Yeah.
And so then they said, well, we can't send you to Vietnam.
Yeah.
And I said, well, what do I do? He said, well, we'll give you an option. You can go to Andrews Air Force Base and have an operation pick you up, and then we can send you to Vietnam. I said, great, send me there.
Now, I tell you, Peter, we've got to take a break here, but I know in talking to you and prepping for the show, you described that most of the work you did in Vietnam is top secret, so we can't get into that. That's why I've got John here, because he, you know, also did top secret stuff in Vietnam. That would be a bad start to the show. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're pleased to be joined in studio by Peter Sirico. He is an expert on all things Western, a Vietnam veteran. Some great stories coming up. Stick around. We're also, my co-pilot, John Essinger, is joining us here today. So we'll be right back, folks.
see anything like that before?
Hell, I ain't never even heard of anything like that.
Ladies and gentlemen, we played that clip for you. If you're like me and you've seen the movie Tombstone 152 times, our guest today, Peter Schirico, among the other things he's done in his life, he played Texas Jack Vermillion in the movie Tombstone. He's an expert on all things Western. He's also a Vietnam veteran. So, Peter, back to you. We want to get into the Western side of things first, but let's wrap up Vietnam. You were in country how long?
6 months.
Okay.
6 months on a TDY special, top secret thing that we can't talk about. After I got fixed up in the hospital, they sent me over. I won't go into any other details. After that, I came back to Maine, and they had someone else taking over the shop, so I was now in charge of the night shifts. I went to University of Maine during the day. I took a full course, and they closed Dow Air Force Base down. They closed the 75th. They deactivated the 75th, which was the last
time
of flying
you?
Tigers. No.
Okay, I was just checking.
Because of money. Yeah, who knows okay. why. And they sent everybody to new duty stations. They gave me my orders for June 15th to go to the 48th in Langley Air Force Base. And then 2 weeks later, they came back and said, okay, everybody's going. And I was like, I went to my colonel and I said, Colonel, I just enrolled 15 credits at college, my money. Can I stay longer? And he said, what are your original orders? And I said, June 15th. He says, that's when you're going. And so for that whole semester, I did nothing but live. I lived off base because I was an NCO, and I listened to the radio every day. And they had a thing called Pop Quiz, and these two people were playing records. Now, I'm a collector of everything, so I've collected comic books. I collected records. I had an extensive record collection of 45s from the 50s and 60s. And they would play these silly records every day, and I was winning. I won 3 cans of tuna fish, and I had a cabinet full of tuna fish. And one day she was playing this one song. She said, I never heard of this. And her co-host was saying, oh, yeah, it's great. I knew it right away and picked it out. And then they asked me, they said, did you ever think of becoming a disc jockey? And I said, no, I never thought about it. I hung up the phone, called them back in 2 minutes. And I said, yeah, what do I have to do? I said, hey, sitting in a little room talking to myself, playing music. What a great job. So they helped me get my FCC license at the time. We became good friends. And then when I went to Langley, the whole squadron shipped out to Korea. I got there on a Friday, and they said, don't unpack. You're going to Korea on Monday. Well, I only had 5 months to go. They said, if you have less than 6 months, you don't go. I had nothing to do. There was a thing called Project Transition, and I didn't know about it. So I met the lieutenant, and he said, what do you want to do? And I said, I want to be a radio disc jockey. And he said, wait a minute. Colonel in the Air National Guard owned the radio station in town, WGH, 1310 on your dial. And he called him up. He said, Colonel, I have a sergeant here who wants to be a disc jockey. What do we do? He said, send him down to the studio. So I went down to the studio. It was like on-the-job training. They put me on the air after a month. I got paid $2 an hour plus my Air Force pay. And I said, this is great. This is how I'm spending my time. But I wasn't making much money. Now the guy,
you had cans of tuna in the cupboard. I mean, what?
No, that was in Maine. Those were already.
Okay.
So I'm looking at the guy before me had a Porsche. The guy after me had a Mercedes, and I was driving a Corvair. And I said, guys, what's wrong here? And they said, listen, you're still in the service. Have you finished college? And I said, no, but I have a year in so far. He said, when you get out, go back to college. Get a BA in liberal arts. Learn to talk about anything. And, I took his advice, and he said, it's going to take 10 years in the radio business before you go anywhere. So now I'm in college, and one of my professors wants to put me in a play. I've never been in a play in my life. And he said, no, do this play. You're older than everybody else, because I was now 23, going on 24. And in the play, I end up kissing the prettiest girl in the theater department that I had a crush on. And I said, whoa, this is a lot better.
Not a bad gig, huh?
Yeah. This is a lot better than sitting in a little room talking to myself. So I went to speech to theater, minor in film, and I get into things totally. So I was just doing all of that. And, of course, I watched movies and TV shows constantly as a kid. And I said, this is even a better life. I get all the pretty girls. I have all the fun. And the first time I did a play, everybody applauded. And I went, whoa, this is...
Now, Peter, I've read somewhere that you've got more degrees than the thermometer.
Yes.
So there was not just the bachelor's, but what else?
I have a master's degree. I have an AA degree. I have a bachelor's degree, and I have a master's degree.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about, you know, I played that clip from Tombstone where you played Texas Jack Vermillion. And you currently live on 5.5 acres next to 2,400 acres with your lovely bride, Susan, in sort of southern central California. Tell us, I want to go through the film a little bit, but let's jump forward a little bit. You are the founder of Caravan West Productions. That's sort of your production company. You provide everything from props to equipment to the buckaroos to the livestock.
Horses, cows, location. We're the only company that does everything. And it makes me feel better because, like I said, I like to do a lot of things. I do 10 jobs on a movie. And I started this company about 25 years ago. So I've been in the business for 40 years. First 15 years, it was a struggle. I started doing a lot of roles and a lot of parts. But what you have to do is always hope your agent sends you into a casting director for a job. You go in, and then they go, nah, we don't want you. And people get, you know, it's always flavor of the week. So about 25, 26 years ago, I said, what can I do to keep on working in this business that I love? And I created Caravan West. And I wanted to put everything together. I'm one of those guys that watches a Western, and I go, that's the wrong saddle. Those are the wrong clothes. Look at that hat. That's silly. That's the wrong gun.
Well, let me ask you about, so you took your passion for the Western and all things Western, and we've had Dale Dye on the program as well,
yes.
Marine, who's basically did the same thing you're doing, but for military movies. He had to say, he's like, wait a minute, this isn't right. So you're basically that equivalent for Westerns.
Yeah, only a little bit more. Dale brings his expertise in on the military, and he'll bring his cadre of people in to fill in all of these different parts. That's why I created the buckaroos. No one person could do everything. So all of my buckaroos they're horse trainers, they're horseshoers, they're leather makers, they're gunsmiths, they're all of these things, and they all know how to ride, and they all know how to shoot, and I bring them in because it makes it easier for me. So now when we're doing a show, movie comes in and they look at everything, and I say, okay, yeah, I'll do all of this stuff for you at a reasonable price, under budget, on time, with quality, and I get to play a part. And they go, well, yeah, you've been in 65 movies. Yeah, okay. Of course you get to play a part.
Now let me ask you this from a business standpoint. Then are you out there pitching these folks as well? Or I would guess with your experience and reputation, they're coming to you now. But in the early days.
A lot of them come to me, mostly word of mouth,
okay.
Although I do a lot of advertising all over the place. There are other ones, the bigger the movie, the less they come to me, because I do too much, and they don't want one person having all the power.
Mm-hmm.
Tombstone was a fluke, because I worked with the writer and director for a year before we did the movie.
And I tell you, you've got some great Tombstone stories to tell. I want to get to that after the break. Part of the reason I wanted John here is, John, you're also a Western. I still don't even know what you do. You two tours in Vietnam. You weren't in the military.
Well, I've been known to produce some movies. And
you and Peter crossed trails, I should say, somewhere a couple years back, yeah?
Right. I was introduced to him by my nephew, who he knows. And my nephew lives in Fort Worth. He came out, and they were working on a project out in Mescal, so I came out, and that's where I met Peter. And of course, I got to tell you, it's pretty exciting for an old country boy who's grew up as a cowboy. And I'm a Tombstone junkie. As a matter of fact, when I go to anything formal, you've probably seen my form. You know, I dress up in 1880s. I don't wear penguin suits. And I was just recently at a Hollywood thing, and I was the only one there that didn't look like everybody else. So Peter and his types have been a major influence on me.
Okay, well, when we come back, Peter, I'd like to talk about, just a point of personal privilege, because, you know, I get excited about this. One of the other part of your services you provide, you have an arsenal of over 1,000 historically accurate period weapons.
Somewhere between 1,300 and 1,400.
And I want to talk to you about getting me a copy of those six shooters I always see that you never have to reload. How many of those do you have in your...
Depending on editing, hundreds of them.
Well, we'll talk about a scene from Tombstone when we come back about that. But you just said you just acquired some more. And so really, long story short, they can go to CaravanWestProductions.com, see all the stuff you guys can do, soup to nuts, or in this case, buckboards to guns to buckaroos, the whole...
Everything.
Okay.
If we used to do a show called Wild West Tech for the History Channel. The second season, one of the producers came to the other producers and said, if Peter doesn't have it, we don't need it.
Very nice. Okay, when we come back, I'd like you to share a story about Tombstone for us. And then also, I want to get your opinion on all things Western. One of my favorite Western films of all time was Open Range, because my sense was that big final gunfight scene was probably one of the first I've seen that was actually pretty accurate. They actually reloaded their weapons. More often than not, they missed. You know, it wasn't like you could shoot a guy at, you know, 500 yards with a six shooter. So, want to get your opinion on what some of your more accurate Westerns are beyond the ones that you've worked on and produced. Folks, it's your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. Stick around. We'll be back with Vietnam veteran and expert on all things Western, Peter Sirico. John Essinger is joining me in the co-host seat. Welcome back, folks. This is your host, BBG, here on American Warrior Radio. We're really pleased and having a great time. We've got live in studio with us Peter Sirico. Peter is a Vietnam veteran, over 40 years experience, though, in the film industry, behind the camera, in front of the camera, set decorating, providing, well, let's get right to it. Let's talk about guns, because I'd be loving me some guns. Well, you started when you were three, Peter. I mean, come on. Well, Kurt Russell. Then he started when he was, what, four or five, or?
Very, 61, I think. It was 1961 he did his first movie with Elvis Presley.
Yeah, and Kurt Russell was in Tombstone.
In Tombstone.
Well, and let's talk a little bit about the, because I want you to tell you've got a great Val Kilmer story. I want our listeners to hear that. But, you know, you alluded to one of the challenges that, I mean, you go onto a set, you provide the weapons, you provide the armorers, you're doing the consulting, or in this case, you're doing consulting probably and acting. But every once in a while, the final product doesn't quite come out. And I was teasing you about there's in that scene at the shootout at the OK Corral, Val Kilmer fires three shots from
a double-barrel shotgun. And everybody notices that.
Yeah.
Everybody sees that and cringes with that. He also fired, I believe, I counted them right, it was 28 shots when he only had 14 with the two six guns and the shotgun. It's editing. It's after they film everything, and then they go back into editing, and the editors just really don't know anything about guns.
As an expert, what are some of your most cringeworthy moments on Western sets?
Well, the one I was telling you during the break was there was a TV show filmed in Old Tucson in the early 90s, and the sheriff is walking down the street. He closes a double-barrel shotgun. And everybody knows what a double-barrel shotgun closes like. Well, in editing, the sound guy goes, oh, okay, they go to their little sound library of things, closing shotgun, and they put a pump shotgun racking. And it was like, what is, who did that? They don't think about it. They think, let's have more excitement. We were doing a show a couple of years ago, and one of the actors in the show, they're playing poker. And here he is on the poker table. Well, he raised... The guy called him, and then he raises himself again. And I said, you can't do that. You don't raise yourself in a poker game. And he goes, well, I'm doing this because I'm putting more chips in, and it makes it more exciting to see more stuff going on the table. I said, yeah, but everybody will go, no, don't do that. And that's what we have to do constantly on it.
And I would think if I'm paying you money to make a movie historically accurately, I'd listen once in a while.
You would think so. Now, there's a movie that was just out. A very good friend of mine was the technical advisor on it. And there were so many things wrong in it. And I asked him, I said, why didn't they listen? He said, they told me they don't care. Mm. We did Deadwood, the series, and they had all these modern saddles in Deadwood. And David Milch, who created it, said, Peter, I want you by my side all the time. I want to pick your brain. Okay, what's wrong? Well, this is wrong, that's wrong. He went up to them, and the Wrangler said, it's a TV show. Who gives it? Can I say?
No.
I can't say that.
They get the input. Yeah, they know.
Well, it's that thing that stops water from going down and makes a lake. Okay. Who gives a damn?
Well, you just said it then.
Well, it was a dam for stopping water.
Okay. You know, the great thing about Peter, and you go to your website, CaravanWestProductions.com, you talk about your books and, you know, hey, sit down, nice bourbon, cigar, campfire. Tristan, can you just confirm for the higher-ups we do not have any open flame or alcohol in the studio?
Or a cigar.
Thumbs up. Or
lit.
Lit. So, back to, and this is such a great story because, as I understand it, Val Kilmer is, I mean, he's an actor's actor. This guy is a perfectionist. So what happens when a guy tells Val Kilmer he's doing something wrong?
Well, if you know what you're doing, he listens.
Okay.
This is the thing. People warned me about Val. They said, Val, he doesn't like people. He doesn't like other actors. He doesn't like this. He's very, and what I saw about him, and because I've been in the business so long, I said, the man is a consummate actor. He gets into his character. He is his character. And, the first day of shooting, we're filming, and he yelled at the prop guy told him to do something. And he said, why? And he said, I just don't want you doing that. Val lit off at him, yelled at him, used every curse word you could think of, and the guy squirreled away. And within 5-10 minutes, I'm looking over at Val, and I see his gun in his holster is half-cocked.
Mm-hmm.
And I rode over to him, and I said, Val, your gun's half-cocked. And he said, yeah, so? And I said, well, if it's half-cocked and the audience sees it, they're going to know you don't know how to handle a single action. You're either going to break the gun or you're going to hurt yourself. And he goes, I find those who break the rules get ahead, don't you? And I said, okay, Val, I'm not going to say anything. Within 5 minutes, I look over, and he has another gun in his holster. So I ride over to the armorer, who I hired, and he's fixing Val's gun. I said, what happened? He goes, Val broke his gun. I ride back over to Val, and I look at him, and I go, hey, I see you have another gun there. And he goes, I broke it. And he starts laughing, and he knew I knew what I was talking about.
What, in your opinion, what is, you know, I was trying to say open range, but you corrected me. Are there any films that you think best represents what it was really like? I mean, you know, Unforgiven, that was pretty brutal.
Unforgiven was pretty good, except there's a scene where he's firing a Spencer. Now, you never see him reloading the Spencer or shooting the Spencer or cocking it. You'll always see him doing it because the Spencers at that time, at the time of the movie, now they're a little bit better. There's remake Spencers now, but that was an original. And, they couldn't get it to work right.
Now, was that a breech loader?
It was a breech loader.
Okay.
With an 8-round magazine in the sock.
Okay.
And they just didn't get the originals to work properly with blanks.
I want to pick your brain here. John, feel free to jump in. You're unusually quiet over there. What, Peter, you've got all the, well, let's talk, you've got this huge armory. Are all of these real period? I mean, we're talking actual 1800 weapons or some are reproductions or all the above?
I don't like the word reproduction.
Okay.
Continuations. The Italians, whether it's companies like Cimarron or EMF or Taylor's, they all make good guns. And they've gotten a lot better over the years. So they're better than the originals. But yes, I use a lot of originals.
Now I think you've played Wild Bill Hickok as well? Buffalo Bill. Okay. One of the, and I want to talk about who, cause we also, you know, some of these, Wyatt Earp, all these names you hear, but there's also a lot of pretty deadly pistoleros out there that folks have never heard of, but Wild Bill is rumored to have shot a man at 75 yards
right.
with a six shooter.
With a 1851 Navy Colt in .36 caliber. He did it. It was probably a lucky shot, but
okay.
He did it.
So what would be the actual effective range of these peacemakers?
Another reason why as a kid I watched these movies. If you watch The Lone Ranger, he can be riding a horse and shoot a six gun and shoot a gun out of a guy's hand.
Half a mile away.
Exactly. And I do that stuff. I practice and practice and practice. When I first started acting in New York, the first part I had, they gave me a gun, and I realized that I didn't know that much about guns. So for the next 2 years, I went and I got the best experts. Bob Munden, who was in Guinness Book of World Records as a fast draw, I worked with him for over 2 years, where he taught me that. And I got guys to teach me how to shoot a bow and arrow, throw a knife, throw a tomahawk. So I did that. So now, 40 years later, I'm the expert.
Mm-hmm.
But it's what I did. It's what most actors don't do.
Okay.
John has a question.
Yeah.
Yes.
Peter, growing up on Roy Rogers and Hopalong Cassidy, and I remember when somebody got shot, they stood there and kind of wallowed around a little bit and grabbed themselves, and they fell over. And there was never any blood. It didn't look like there was any trauma or anything. But now it's real. So when was the
I don't think it's real now.
Oh, you don't?
They want to do squibs. You see a squib, and you see, you've seen people shot in Vietnam, and the blood doesn't come shooting up four feet. And that's what they did. Sam Peckinpah invented that when they did the Wild Bunch, with all the blood and the gore. And that's not what really happens in life. And if you look at the old movies, which I look at all the time, I'm watching them constantly, there's two things that I notice. A bad guy gets shot, and he's basically dead. He doesn't move again. But whatever good guy gets shot, whether it's a girl or a guy, they're only wounded.
Yeah, just shot in the arm, usually.
Yeah. They're only always wounded, and they always can come back. And they never do that. And the guys, like you were saying, Ben, they shoot the gun endlessly.
Mm-hmm.
And then what drives me crazy is they always put an empty gun back in their holster. They don't reload.
Yeah, why would you do that? Well,
why would you do that?
Yeah.
True Grit with Jeff Bridges.
The new one, okay.
The new one. He's shooting, boom, 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 he's shooting the guns out there. He's on a manhunt after man killers. He shoots a gun and then he puts the gun right back in his holster. In the middle of, I said, what are reload. They don't do that in movies because, again, it's actors who aren't really, they're not comfortable with it.
Sure.
Now, I can reload a six shooter on horseback riding.
Wow.
Nobody can do that. But I practiced it and I did it constantly. We used to go on a thing called the House of Men Ride where six of us would go up in the mountains at night with 100 rounds of ammunition, a couple of cigars, and each guy had at least a pint of whiskey. And we wouldn't come back until it was all done. The cigars were done, the whiskey was done, the bullets were good. And this is all live ammo.
Well, you know, Peter, when we come back, I want to talk about some of those real folks. You mentioned you worked on Deadwood, one of my favorite series ever. I think a lot of folks, unless they bothered to do the research, Seth Bullock was a real person.
Yeah, they were all real people.
Yeah, Swearingen. I actually read that, with 1870s, this guy, his gem saloon was pulling in about $5,000 a night. In the 1870s?
That, I don't know what the quality was on that, but I will tell you a good gun story on.
And Texas Jack Vermillion was also a real dude.
Texas Jack was a real dude, Turkey Creek, they were all real dudes.
Okay, I tell you folks, when we come back, I want to talk about some of those other real dudes you may not have never heard of, many of whom could actually do some of the things we see in movies, dead eyes shooting from horseback. Welcome back, folks. This is your host, BBG. We're live in studio with Vietnam veteran and expert on all things Western, Peter Schirraker. Peter has appeared in over 150 films and television shows?
68 films and several hundred TV shows.
But who's counting?
Yeah, I don't count. I look at the checks.
Smart guy. And flying co-pilot with us, one of my other favorite Vietnam veterans and Western aficionados, John Essinger. We should start calling him Quiet John. Everybody's got a handle.
It's tough to be quiet when you're on the radio.
Well, you know, when you're in the presence of someone like you and Peter, you know.
Oh, man.
You know, it's like I just probably ought to listen.
Get out that one-cent check, Peter. We're going to have to give it to him. Let's talk about, I mentioned, you know, Texas Jack. If folks don't know, Texas Jack Vermillion, the character you played in Tombstone, was a real guy. Who are some of the other just really bad dudes from the West who just didn't have a good publicist, who people have never heard about? I mean, I've got a list here, but I'd be curious who you think of.
I don't know.
Okay.
There were a lot of guys, and they were all tough. I have a new book. I'm writing another book called The West, Reality of the Myth.
Okay.
And that will have a lot of stories about different people that no one's heard of or you haven't seen on TV. You know, we do a lot of documentary shows, and every documentary show coming out has the same guys. Wyatt Earp, Jesse James, Billy the Kid, Wild Bill Hickok, and I keep on saying, those six people, five, six, seven people, are not the only ones that existed in the West. It was so many other people that did something.
Well, let me ask you this, because this maybe is covered in your new book. Was the Wild West really as violent as, I mean, in
as
general.
Chicago?
Well, no, nowadays, maybe, probably not, but I mean, back then, it's not like there was a gunfight in the street every single day and there was a cattleman riding through town.
It depends on what part of history you're looking at. Bodie, California, there was a saying back then in their newspapers that there was a man served for breakfast every day.
Mm-hmm.
But when they were writing pulp novels, when they're writing stories, when they're writing these little dime novels, when they're writing, doing movies or TV shows, you have to focus on the dramatic stuff. I mean, even when we did Tombstone, Tombstone was not, did not take place in that short of time that the story takes place. It took place over a period of years, but you can't go into that period of years because you'll bore the people.
Yeah.
I mean, it was, people did a lot of work.
And you know, one of the ironies now is talk about reality. It is easier to get and carry a weapon in Tombstone today than it was back then. Yeah. Well, listen, Harvey Kid Curry, Logan.
Yeah.
Considered by many fastest gun in the West. I understand that the Sundance Kid of Hollywood was based on Kid Curry, which is ironic because he actually rode with the Wild Bunch as well, correct?
Kid Curry rode with the Wild Bunch with Sundance, with Butch Cassidy. There were several other people in there. You know, that's one thing I talk about, the Butch Cassidy to Sundance Kid. Great movie. It's a fun movie.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at it, all modern saddles, Buscadero gun belts, which did not exist until 1920, but they were putting them in.
And describe to our listeners what that is.
The Buscadero gun belt is the one with the slot in there where the holster fits through, and they tie it around their leg, and then they have the hammer thong. How many movies have you watched where they have a dramatic scene where the guy reaches down towards his gun and he takes the hammer thong off so you know he's getting ready? In the Old West, if somebody was going to reach down for their gun, he would have been shot. They would, oh, wait, I got to wait to be prepared.
Wait till,
I got to tie it around my leg tighter. No, you don't do that. You know, the old style holsters and gun belts, people were tough. You know, like you were mentioning Texas John Slaughter.
Mm-hmm.
These guys were tough. There's a book, 101 Questions on the Old West, and one of the questions was, what did they do with cowards on the wagon train? And the answer was, there were no cowards on the wagon train. You died or you made it.
Yeah. Good
you
know, point.
You had to be tough. And that's one of the things that drives me crazy about movies. Movies are always, the hero is God. The bad guy is a bully. And everybody else is a quivering piece of jelly. Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm afraid. That's not how it was.
What, Deacon Jim Miller, ring a bell as well?
Yeah, killing Jim Miller.
His favorite, his weapon of choice seems to be a shotgun. But what's also interesting to me about him was you see this in the movies occasion, but he actually wore an iron plate, as I understand it, under his clothes, and that's part of the reason he survived some of these shootouts.
Yep. We made one up. We did a documentary on one of the documentary series on killing Jim Miller, and we had that plate made up, which wasn't real. I mean, if you shot through it, he would have been dead. But yeah, that was one of the things. And there's a Clint Eastwood movie where he has a plate that he puts on his under his poncho, and he keeps on telling him, shoot for the heart, and he keeps on shooting for the heart, but he's never falling.
Now, something else interesting, I don't know, it was on the internet, so I don't know if it's true or not. I understand he was married to John Wesley Hardin's cousin. You know anything about that?
Jim Miller? They were related. I have to go back into more of the Hardin story. There is a movie a script that a friend of mine has been trying to get together for 5 years now, 6 years now, on John Wesley Hardin. Because he was an interesting guy, but I keep on telling him, I said, you don't want to do it on his whole life. You want to do it on one part of the life. That's why Tombstone is so much better than Wyatt Earp. Wyatt Earp carried Wyatt Earp's
unbearably long
whole life.
Yeah.
Whereas Tombstone focused on that one section.
Dallas Studemeyer, I find him interesting. This guy apparently was involved in more gunfights than Wyatt Earp, Bat Masterson, all these guys. His
1885 El Paso.
Yeah, what, five dead in 4 seconds, four dead in 5 seconds.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, I mean these, so how many of
these guys were tough? They knew what they were shooting at. See, in movies, again, with modern weapons that everybody sees in all of these, you know, where they're with the machine guns and the Uzis and the AK-47s and the AR-15s or M-16s, where they're just shooting constant spray and pray. In the Old West, you didn't do that. You had a gun. You had six shots in your gun. You're not going to waste them. You're not going to go into a building and shoot up in the air to get everybody's attention. You're going to shoot the guy. That's what I'd like to see in a movie. I'd like to see if two guys are having a fight and the guy's going to break it up, he shoots one of them.
What, do you shoot at an OK Corral? I don't know how many rounds were fired. I mean, we're talking 30 seconds, right?
Yeah.
And were most of these folks, did they carry two weapons?
No. Everybody there, except for Doc, who carried his other guns and the shotgun, which he got from Virgil Earp, And, you know, Wyatt had his one gun, and nobody has, the actual official thing. When you look at the court documents, and they don't mention, he had this gun, this color with a, with ivory grips, with a blue.
But safe to say, no one probably reloaded, except for maybe the shotgun.
You know, the one guys that I like, Jesse James, Quantrell's Raiders, they would carry 6 to 8 guns with them, because they were all cap and balls, they took forever to load. So they would come in and just shoot up everybody. As soon as they were done, they'd run out.
They wouldn't. Peter, the great show always goes by fast. We've got just a couple of minutes left. Two quick questions for you. If you were to make a film about the most underrated or never heard of gunslinger, who would it be?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know who the underrated or best gunslinger. I like to make films about real people and put real stuff in them and give them that situation that you would face. And it's always, and it's what I tell people, what they want to do with their life. Follow your heart. As Buffalo Bill said, cut your own trail and follow your own spirit guide. Davy Crockett said, a man has an inner voice inside him which tells him what to do. When you're sure you're right, go ahead. One of the Texas Rangers said, if you're right, you can charge hell with a bucket of water and win. That's why Texas Rangers were so tough. That's why Arizona Rangers are so tough. These guys did things that were right, that their heart told them that was right. And that's what I do. And that's what I tell people to do. Follow your own spirit guide. Follow that and you can't go wrong.
So that's great advice for anyone, Peter. Any particular, as a veteran who's built a very successful career, any other advice you have particular to the men and women maybe coming out of our military nowadays who are looking to cut their trail?
There's something inside everybody that tells them what to do, that you're going to be happy with. And I always say, find a job that you like. Find something that excites you. I don't go to work every day. People ask me, are you going to retire? And I say, I can't retire. I never had a job. I do what I love to do, and I look forward to doing it every day. That's why I travel all around the country. I buy stuff constantly because I'm going to do this, and that's what I recommend to people. I do a lot of colleges, right? I'm speaking at colleges to try and get people motivated to do what they want. We were talking about an inspiration before.
Yeah.
Think about it. It's in spirit. It's in the spirit in you.
Peter, thank you so much for your time. Thanks for joining us. John, thanks for flying co-pilot with me. Ladies and gentlemen, visit AmericanWarriorRadio.com for podcasts. Like us on Facebook, American Warrior Radio. You can also find us on Twitter at Warrior Radio TUC. Until next time, ladies and gentlemen, all policies and procedures are to remain in place. Take care.